You store your things in Chinatown.
I can?
Yes, you can. It would have to be a safe place.
Yes,
Ling Chao has tool shed. Very strong and just new. It has lock and no windows except small windows at the top.
Where is it?
Behind Ling Chao restaurant.
In the middle of Chinatown.
It would be perfect. Johnson felt a rush of gratitude.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate your offer very much. No one else in this town will even $10 a night.
What?
$10 a night.
Okay.
I can't afford $10 a night.
Unblinking.
You can.
That's outrageous.
That's the price.
Okay.
Johnson thought it over.
Okay, he said.
Okay.
At this time, I still had more than 1,000 pounds of fossils, Johnson later recalled. 10 boxes weighing about 100 pounds each. I hired Kim Sing's boy, Kang, to help me with the wagon. I paid him $2 for the afternoon, and he earned it. He kept saying, "What is this?" And I kept telling him it was old bones. But my story didn't get more persuasive. I also didn't know there were so many Chinamen in Deadwood. It seemed to me their smooth, impassive faces were everywhere, watching me, commenting to each other, standing 4 deep around the tool shed, peering from windows in the surrounding buildings. Finally, when all the crates were stacked neatly in the tool shed, Kang looked at them and said, "Why you care so much?" I said I didn't know anymore. Then I went to the Grand Central for dinner, and returned to the tool shed at nightfall, to keep my evening watch over the dinosaur bones. He did not have long to wait. Around 10, shadowy figures appeared around the high transom windows. Johnson cocked his gun. There were several figures outside. He heard whispered voices. The window creaked open. A hand reached down. Johnson saw a dark head appear in the narrow glass. He aimed his gun.
"Get away, you bastards!"
A sharp giggle startled him. They were kids. Chinese kids. He lowered his gun.
"Get away. Go on, get away."
The giggling continued, scraping footsteps, and he was alone again. He sighed. It was a good thing he hadn't shot hastily, he thought. There was more scraping.
"Didn't you hear me? Get out of here!"
Probably they didn't speak English, he thought, but most of the young ones had passable English, and the older ones spoke a lot more English than they were willing to admit they did. Another head at the window, shadowy.
"Get away, you kids!"
"Mr. Johnson?"
It was Kang.
"Yes?"
"I have the bad news for you."
"What?"
"I think everybody know you here. People in laundry say talking you move boxes to this place." Johnson froze. Of course they knew. He'd merely exchanged one room in town for another.
"Kang, you know my wagon?"
"Yes, yes.
It's at the stable."
"Can you get it and bring it here?"
"Yes."
It seemed he returned only a few minutes later. "Tell your friends to load the boxes as fast as possible." Kang did that, and soon the wagon was loaded. Johnson gave them $1 and told them to run away. "Kang, stay with me." Chinatown was larger than it looked, with new streets being built constantly. Kang showed him how to guide the wagon through the narrow lanes. At one point they stopped as 4 horsemen went by in a hurry in the street ahead.
"Look for you, I think," said Kang.
They eased out onto a side road, and in a few minutes they came to the tall pine where Johnson had buried Little Wind. The ground was still soft, and he and Kang gently exhumed Little Wind, holding their breaths as they pulled him out of the hole. The stench was wretched. The 10 boxes took up the space of about 2 more graves, and Johnson widened the hole he had made for Little Wind and stacked the boxes as evenly as he could. Then he laid Little Wind on top of the boxes,
as if he were sleeping atop them. If I had my camera and it was daytime, I would take a photograph of that, Johnson told himself. He piled the dirt back over Little Wind, spreading it around so the excess would not be so apparent, then brushed pine needles over the spot. This is our secret, he told Kang.
Yes?
But it can be a better secret.
Yes, of course.
Johnson pulled a $5 gold piece from his pocket. You do not tell anyone.
No, no.
But he did not trust the boy not to talk. When I leave, Kang, I will pay you another $5 if you have kept the secret.
Another $5?
Yes. The day I leave Deadwood. A shootout. Black Dick showed up in a rage at the Grand Hotel at breakfast time the same morning. He kicked open the door.
Where is the little bastard?
His gaze fell on Johnson. I'm not a shooting man, Johnson said, as calmly as he could.
No coward is.
You may hold whatever opinion you like.
You shot Clem in the back. You are a yellow-bellied snake.
He was robbing my property. Dick spat.
You shot him in the back, you son of a poxy whore.
Johnson shook his head. I won't be provoked.
You hear this, Dick said. You meet me outside now, or I'll go to that shed in Chinatown and plug every one of your precious crates with dynamite and blow 'em to smithereens. Might blow up some of those Chinamen who helped you, too.
You wouldn't dare.
I can't see who might stop me.
You care to watch me blow your precious bones?
Johnson felt a strange, deep fury fill him. All his frustrations, all the difficulties of his weeks in Deadwood overwhelmed him. He was glad he had moved the crates. He began to breathe deeply, slowly. His face felt oddly tight.
No. Johnson said.
He stood. I'll see you outside, Dick.
That's fine, Dick said. I'll be waiting on you.
And Dick left, slamming the door behind him. Johnson sat in the hotel dining room. The other breakfasters looked at him. Nobody spoke. Sunlight came in through the windows. He heard a bird chirping. He heard the rattle of wagons in the street outside. The people shouting to each other to clear out, that there was going to be some gunplay. He heard Mrs. Wilson's piano lessons in the next building, a child playing scales. Johnson felt completely unreal. Minutes later, Wyatt Earp hurried into the dining room.
What's this foolishness about you and Dick Curry?
It's true. Earp stared at him a moment, then said,
Take my advice, and back out.
I'm not backing out, Johnson said.
Can you shoot?
Not real good.
That's unfortunate.
But I'm going up against him anyway.
You want some advice? Or you want to die your own way?
I will be grateful for any advice, Johnson said. He noticed that his lip was quivering, his hand shaking.
Sit down, Earp said. I've been through lots of these. And it's always the same. You get a pistolier like Dick. He is pretty full of himself, and he has shot a man or two. He's fast. But mostly his victims have been drunk or scared, or both.
I surely am scared.
That's fine. Just remember, most of these gunmen are cowards and bullies. They have a trick that works for them. You must avoid his tricks.
Such as what? What tricks?
Some of 'em try and rush you. Some of 'em try and distract you. They smoke a cigar, toss it away, expecting your eyes naturally to follow it. Some of 'em try and talk to you. Some of 'em yawn, try to get you to yawn. Tricks.
What should I do? Johnson's heart was hammering so loudly he could hardly hear his own voice.
When you go out there, you take your time, and never take your eyes off him. He may try and shoot you while you're stepping into the street. Never take your eyes off him. Then take your position. Put your feet wide. Get your balance. Don't let him engage you in talk. Concentrate on him. Never take your eyes off him, no matter what he does. Watch his eyes. You'll see in his eyes when he's going to make his play, even before his hand moves.
How will I see it?
You'll see it. Don't worry. Let him fire first. You draw deliberate, you aim deliberate, and you squeeze off one shot right to the middle of his stomach. Don't do anything fancy like aim for the head. Make it count. Shoot him in the stomach and kill him.
Oh, God.
The reality of it was settling in on him. You sure you won't back out?
No.
Fine, Earp said. I believe you'll come out. Dick's cocky. He thinks you're a mark. You can't ask for better than a cocky man to go up against.
I'm glad to hear of it.
You'll come out, Earp said again. Is your gun loaded?
No.
Better load it, boy. Johnson stepped out of the hotel into the morning light. The main street of Deadwood was deserted. There was silence, except for Mrs. Wilson's piano lesson, monotonous scales. Black Dick was at the north end of the street, waiting. He puffed on a cigar. His broad hat put his face in deep shadow. Johnson had trouble seeing his eyes. He hesitated.
"Come on out, Foggy," Dick called.
Johnson stepped away from the hotel into the street. He felt his feet squish in the mud. He did not look down. "Keep your eyes on him. Never take your eyes off him." Johnson moved to the middle of the street, stopped. "Get your balance. Get your feet wide." Clearly, he heard Mrs. Wilson's voice say, "No, no, Charlotte. Tempo. Concentrate. Concentrate on him." They were 30 feet apart, on the main street of Deadwood in the morning sunshine. Dick laughed.
"Come closer, Foggy."
"This'll do," Johnson said.
"I can't hardly see you, Foggy."
"Don't let him talk to you. Watch him." "I see fine," Johnson said. Dick laughed. The laugh trailed off into silence. "Watch his eyes. Watch his eyes."
"Any last requests, Foggy?"
Johnson did not answer. He felt his heart pounding in his chest. Black Dick threw his cigar away. It sailed through the air, sputtered in the mud. "No matter what he does, never take your eyes off him." Dick drew. It happened very fast. Dick's body was obscured by a cloud of dense black smoke, and two bullets whizzed past Johnson before his own gun was out, and he felt the third knock his hat off as he aimed and fired. His gun bucked in his hand. He heard a scream of pain.
"Son of a bitch! I'm hit!"
Johnson peered through the smoke, more confused than anything else. At first he could see nothing. Dick seemed to have disappeared entirely from the street. Then the smoke cleared, and he saw the figure writhing in the mud.
"You shot me! Damn! You shot me!"
Johnson stood and stared. Dick struggled to his feet, clutching his bleeding shoulder, his wounded arm hanging limply. He was covered in mud.
"Damn you!"
"Finish him," thought Johnson. But he had already killed a man, and didn't have the heart to shoot again now. He watched as Dick staggered across the street and swung onto his horse.
"I'll get you for this. I'll get you," he cried.
And he rode out of town. Johnson watched him go. He heard scattered cheers and applause from the surrounding buildings. He felt dizzy, and his legs went watery.
"You did good," Earp said, "exceptin' you didn't kill him."
"I'm not a gunman."
"That's fine," Earp said. "But Mark, you should have killed him. It didn't look to me his wounds were mortal. And now you have an enemy for life."
"I couldn't kill him, Wyatt.
Erp looked at him for a while. You're a downeaster. That's the trouble. Haven't got any common sense. You're gonna have to get out of town pronto, you know.
Why is that?
Because, boy, you have a reputation now.
Johnson laughed. Everybody in town knows who I am.
Not anymore, Erp said. It turned out that Foggy Bill Johnson, the man who gunned down Clem Curry and then went up against his brother Dick, was indeed a notorious celebrity in Deadwood. Every man who fancied himself sharp with a gun was suddenly asking to meet him. After 2 days of extricating himself from gunfights, Johnson realized that Erp was right. He would have to leave Deadwood soon. He had just enough money to buy fare and freight on the express stage, and purchased his ticket for the following day. When the light was low, he took one of the horses and checked to see that Little Wind's grave had not been disturbed. So far it hadn't. The ground had hardened up in the cold, and he had left no tracks. Even so, he forced himself to leave immediately, lest he be noticed. Erp, meanwhile, had grown tired of gambling and a desultory courting of Miss Emily. He had expected Deadwood to offer him a position as marshal, but no offer was forthcoming, so he was going to head south for the winter.
When are you leaving? Johnson asked.
What's it to you?
Perhaps you could ride with me.
With you and your bones? Erp laughed.
Boy, every bandito and desperado from here to Cheyenne is just waiting for you to leave Deadwood with those bones.
I'd be sure to make it if you rode with me.
I think I'll wait, to escort Miss Emily. Miss Emily might come tomorrow, too, especially if you were riding with us.
Erp fixed him with a steady look. What's in it for me, boy?
I bet the stage would pay you as a messenger.
A messenger was a guard. They made good money. Can't you do any better than that?
I guess not.
There was a silence. Finally, Erp said, tell you what. If I get you through to Cheyenne, you give me half your shipment.
Half my bones?
That's right, he said, smiling broadly and winking. Half your bones. How's that sound?
I realized then, Johnson wrote on the evening of September 28th, that Mr. Erp was like all the others, and did not believe that these crates contained bones at all. I was faced with a moral dilemma. Mr. Erp had been friendly to me and helpful more than once. I was asking him to face real danger, and he thought he was risking his life for treasure. It was my obligation to disabuse him of his greedy misconception. But I had received quite an education out west, one that Yale had been unable to provide. A man has to look out for himself, I'd learned. So all I said to him was, Mr. Erp, you have cut yourself a deal. The stage would leave Deadwood the following morning. He woke a few hours past midnight. It was time to retrieve the crates of bones. By pre-arrangement, he had hired Kang to help him again, since no white man would want to dig up a dead Indian. They rode the wagon out of town, and the first thing they did was excavate Little Wind, who did not smell quite as bad as he had before, because of the cold air. One by one, the crates went into the wagon. They were dirty and moist from being underground, but appeared otherwise fine. This time Johnson filled in most of the grave before returning Little Wind to the earth. He paused at the sight of him. The grotesquery was not Little Wind's rotting gray visage, Johnson realized. It was that he had now buried this poor man 3 times. Little Wind had died to protect him. And in return, he had not let him rest in peace.
The Cheyenne Road. Once in town, he continued to the stagecoach station. The coach was already there. It had started to snow again, and a chill wind moaned through Deadwood Gulch. Johnson was glad to be leaving, and methodically hoisted the crates onto the coach. Despite the assurances of the agent, the bones could not all ride up top with the enormously fat driver, Tiny Tim Edwards. Johnson was obliged to purchase an extra passenger seat and place some of them inside. Fortunately, the only passengers were Miss Emily and himself. Then they had to wait for Wyatt Earp, who was nowhere to be found. Johnson stood in the snow with Miss Emily, looking up and down the bleak street of Deadwood. "Maybe he's not coming after all," Johnson said. "I think he will come," Miss Emily said. While they waited, a red-headed boy ran up to Johnson. "Mr. Johnson?" "That's right." The boy gave Johnson a note and scampered away. Johnson opened it, read it quickly, and crumpled it. "What is it?" Miss Emily asked. "Just a goodbye from Judge Harlan." Around 9, they saw the Earp brothers coming down the street toward them. They both appeared heavily burdened. "When they were closer," Johnson wrote, "I saw that the Earps had obtained a collection of firearms. I had never seen Wyatt Earp wearing a gun before. He seldom went armed in public. But now he carried a veritable arsenal." Earp was late because he had to wait for Sutter's dry goods to open, to obtain guns. He carried 2 sawed-off shotguns, 3 Pierce repeating rifles, 4 Colt revolvers, and 12 boxes of ammunition. Johnson said, "It appears you were expecting some warm work." Earp told Miss Emily to climb into the stage. Then he said, "I don't want to alarm her any." And then he told Johnson that he thought they faced a deal of trouble, and no point in pretending it won't come. Johnson showed Earp the note, which read, "I promise you are a dead man today, or my name is not Dick Curry." "That's fine," Earp said. "We're ready for him." Wyatt's brother Morgan had made a lucrative deal to haul firewood and was planning to stay in Deadwood for the winter, but said that he would ride with Wyatt and the stage as far as Custer City, 50 miles to the south. Tiny Tim leaned over the box. "You gents gonna palaver all day, or are you ready to crack leather?" "We are," Earp said. "Then climb aboard this item. Can't go nowhere standing in the street, can you?" Johnson climbed onto the stage with Miss Emily, and for the 10th time that morning attended to his crates, cinching them down tightly. Morgan Earp climbed onto the top of the stage, and Wyatt rode shotgun. A Chinese boy in cowboy boots came running toward the stagecoach. It was Kang, with a worried look on his face. Johnson fished in his pocket and found a $5 gold piece. "Kang!" He leaned out the open door and flipped the glittering coin high into the air. Kang caught it on the run with remarkable grace. Johnson nodded at him, knowing he would never see the boy again. Tim snapped his whips, the horses snorted, and they galloped out of Deadwood in the swirling snow. It was a 3-day journey to Fort Laramie, one day to Custer City in the center of the Black Hills, a second day through the treacherous Red Canyon to the Red Canyon stagecoach station at the southern edge of the Black Hills, and the third day across the Wyoming plains to the newly built iron bridge that crossed the Platte River at Laramie. Earp assured him the trip would get safer as they went, and if they reached Laramie, they would be entirely safe. From then on, the road from Laramie to Cheyenne was patrolled by cavalry. If they reached Laramie. 3 obstacles stood between us and our destination, Johnson later wrote in his journal. The first was Black Dick and his gang of ruffians. We could expect to meet them during the first day. Second was Persimmon's Bill and his renegade Indians. We could expect to meet them in Red Canyon on the second day. And the third obstacle was the most dangerous of all, and wholly unanticipated by me. Johnson had steeled himself for a dangerous journey, but he was unprepared for its sheer physical hazards. The Black Hills roads were bad, necessitating slow travel. Drop-offs were precipitous, and the fact that the coach swayed ominously near the crumbling edge under its load of bones did not reassure them. Several creeks, the Bear Butte, Elk, and Box Elder, were transformed from the recent snows into swollen, raging rivers. The fact that the coach was so heavily laden made the crossings especially dangerous. As Tiny explained it, "This item gets stuck in the quicksand, middle of the river. We don't go anywheres unless we ride back for an extra team. Pull this item out, and that's a fact." And along with the difficulties, they lived under the continuous threat of attack at any moment. The tension was nerve-wracking, for the smallest impediment could be dangerous. Around noon, the coach stopped. Johnson looked out. "Why are we stopping?" "Keep your head in," Earp snapped. "If you don't want to lose it, fallen tree up ahead."
"So?"
Morgan Earp peered over from the top of the coach.
"Miss Emily, I'd be much obliged, ma'am, if you would get yourself low and stay there until we're moving again."
"It's just a fallen tree," Johnson said. Soil was thin in many places in the Black Hills, and trees often fell across the road.
"Maybe so," Earp said. "Maybe not."
He pointed out that high hills surrounded the road on all sides. The trees came right to the road, providing good close cover.
"If they're going for us, this'd be a good place."
Tiny Tim got down off the box and went forward to inspect the fallen tree. Johnson heard the sharp clash-clack of shotguns being cocked.
"Is there really danger?" Miss Emily asked.
She did not seem the least anxious.
"I guess there is," Johnson said.
He withdrew his pistol, looked down the barrel, spun the chambers. Beside him, Miss Emily gave a little shiver of excitement. But the tree was a small one, fallen by natural causes. Tiny moved it, and they drove on. An hour later, near Silver Peak and Pactola, they came upon a rock slide and repeated the procedure. But again, they had no trouble. "When the attack finally came," Johnson wrote, "it was almost a relief." Wyatt Earp shouted, "You below! Heads in!" and his shotgun roared. It was answered by gunfire from behind them. They were at the bottom of Sand Creek Gulch. The road ran straight here, with room on both sides for horsemen to keep up and discharge their guns into the open coach. They heard Morgan Earp, directly above them, scraping over the roof of the coach, and they felt it sway as he took a position near the back. There was more firing. Wyatt called distinctly, "Get down, Morg, I'm shooting!" There was more firing. Tiny whipped the horses, cursed them. Bullets thunked into the wood of the coach. Johnson and Emily ducked down, but the crates of fossils, precariously strapped to the seat above, threatened to tumble down on them. Johnson got up on his knees and tried to cinch them tighter. A horseman rode alongside the coach, aimed at Johnson, and in a sudden explosion, disappeared from the horse. Astonished, Johnson looked out.
"Foggy, get your head in! I'm shooting!"
Johnson ducked back in, and Earp's shotgun blasted past the open window. More gunshots from riders outside splintered the doorposts of the carriage. There was a scream. Cursing and shouting, Tiny whipped the horses. The coach rocked and jolted over the rough road. Inside the carriage, Johnson and Miss Emily collided and bounced against each other, in a manner which would be embarrassing were circumstances not so exigent, Johnson later wrote. The next period, it seemed hours, though it was probably a minute or two, was a nervous blend of whining bullets, galloping horses, shouts and screams, jolts and gunshots, until finally our coach rounded a bend, and we were out of Sand Creek Gulch, and the shooting died off, and we were safely on our way once more. We had survived the attack of the notorious Curry Gang.
"Only a damn fool would think so," Wyatt said when they stopped to rest and change horses at the Tigerville coach station.
"Why?
Wasn't that the Curry Gang attacking us? And didn't we get away?"
"Look, boy," Wyatt said, "I know you're from back east, but nobody's that stupid.
He reloaded his shotguns as he spoke.
Johnson didn't understand, so Morganerp explained.
Black Dick wants you pretty bad, and he wouldn't risk all in such an ill-made attack.
Johnson, who had found the attack terrifying, said, Why was it ill-made?
Riskiest attack there is on horseback, Morgan said. Riders can't shoot worth a damn. The coach is always moving, and unless they can shoot one of the horses in the team, it's very likely to get away just as we did. There's no certainty in a horseback attack.
Then why'd they try one?
To put us at our ease, Wyatt said. To put us off our guard.
You mark my words. They know we have to stop and change teams at Tigerville. Right now they're riding like hell to set up again.
Set up where?
If I knew that, Wyatt said, I wouldn't be worried. What do you think, Morg?
Somewhere between here and Sheridan, I figure, Morgan Earp said.
That's what I figure too, Wyatt Earp said, cracking his shotgun closed. And the next time, they'll really mean business.
The second attack. Half an hour farther on, they halted at the edge of the pine woods, before the sandy banks of Spring Creek. The meandering water was deceptively low, and more than 100 yards wide. The late afternoon sun glowed off the slow, peaceful ripples. On the far bank, the pine woods were thick and dark. They watched the river silently for several minutes. Finally, Johnson poked his head out to ask why they were waiting. Morgan Earp, on top of the stage, leaned over and tapped him on the head and held his finger to his lips to be silent. Johnson sat back in the coach, rubbed his head, and looked questioningly at Miss Emily. Miss Emily shrugged and slapped a mosquito. Several minutes passed before Wyatt Earp said to Tiny, How's it look to you?
Don't know, Tiny said.
Earp peered at the tracks on the sandy riverbank. Lots of horses passed here recently.
That's usual, Tiny said.
Sheridan's just a couple of miles south on the other side.
They fell silent again, waiting, listening to the quiet gurgle of the water, the wind in the pines.
You know, there's usually birds hereabouts at Spring Creek, Tiny said finally.
Too quiet, Earp said.
I'd say too quiet.
How's the bottom? Earp asked, looking at the river.
Never know till you get there.
You want to make a play?
I guess I do, Earp said. He swung down off the box, walked back, and looked into the coach at Johnson and Miss Emily.
We're going to try to cross the creek, he said quietly. If we get across, fine. If we get trouble, you stay down, no matter what you see or hear.
Morg knows what to do. Let him handle things.
Okay?
They nodded. Johnson's throat was dry.
You think it's a trap?
Earp shrugged.
It's a good place for one.
He climbed back onto the box and cocked his shotgun. Tiny whipped up the horses and they started across at breakneck speed, the coach lurching as the wheels hit the soft sandy banks and then splashing and jouncing over rocks in the riverbed.
And then the shooting started. Johnson heard the whinny of the horses, and with a final lurch, the coach stopped abruptly, right in the middle of the river, and Tiny shouted, That tears it! And Morgan Earp began firing rapidly.
I'll cover you, Wyatt!
Johnson and Miss Emily ducked down. Bullets whined all around them, and the coach rocked as the men moved above them. Johnson peeked over the sill and saw Wyatt Earp running, splashing through the river toward the far shore.
He's leaving.
Wyatt's leaving us, Johnson cried, and then a fusillade sent him diving for cover again.
He wouldn't abandon us, Emily said.
He just did, Johnson shouted. He was completely panicked. Suddenly the coach door swung open and Johnson screamed as Tiny threw himself in, landing on top of them. Tiny was gasping and white-faced. He pulled the door shut as a half dozen bullets splintered the wood.
What's happening? Johnson asked.
Ain't no place for me out there, Tiny said.
But what's happening?
We're stuck in the middle of the damn river, that's what's happening, Tiny said.
They killed one of the team, so we ain't going nowhere, and the Earp boys are shooting away like blazes. Wyatt took off. They have a plan?
I surely hope so, Tiny said, 'cause I don't.
As the gunfire continued, he clasped his hands together and closed his eyes. His lips twitched.
What are you doing?
Praying, Tiny said. You better too, 'cause if Black Dick takes this stage, he'll just naturally kill us all.
In the reddish afternoon light, the stagecoach sat immobile in the middle of Spring Creek. On top of the stage, Morgan Earp lay flat and fired into the trees on the opposite shore. Wyatt made it safely to the far bank and plunged into the pine woods opposite. Almost immediately, the shooting from the far side diminished. The Curry gang had something new to worry about now. Then from the far shore there was a shotgun blast and a loud scream, agonizing. It trailed away into silence. After a moment, another shotgun blast and a strangled cry. The Curry gang stopped firing at the coach. Then a voice cried, "Don't shoot, Wyatt, please don't!" And another blast. Suddenly, half a dozen voices on the far shore were shouting to each other, and then they heard horses galloping off. And then, nothing. Morgan Earp knocked on the roof of the coach.
"It's finished," he said. "They're gone. You can breathe now."
The passengers inside struggled to their feet, brushed themselves off. Johnson looked out and saw Wyatt Earp standing on the far bank, grinning. His sawed-off shotgun hung loosely in his hand. He walked slowly back through the stream toward them.
"First rule of a bushwhacking," he said. "Always run toward the direction of fire, not away."
"How many'd you kill?"
Johnson asked.
"All of them?"
Earp grinned again.
"None of them."
"None of them?"
"Those woods are thick. You can't see 10 feet ahead of you. I'd never find them in there. But I knew they were spread out along the bank and probably couldn't see each other directly. So I just shot my gun a few times and made a few hideous cries."
"Wyatt can really make hideous cries," Morgan said.
"That's so," Wyatt said. "The Curry gang panicked and ran."
"You mean you just tricked them?" Johnson said. In a strange way, he felt disappointed.
"Listen," Wyatt Earp said. "One reason I'm still alive is I don't go asking for trouble. These boys are none too quick, and they got an active imagination. Besides, we got a bigger problem than getting rid of the Curry boys."
"We do?"
"Yeah. We got to get this coach out of the river."
"Why is that a problem?"
Earp sighed.
"Boy, you ever tried to move a dead horse?"
It took an hour to cut the animal loose and float it downstream. Johnson watched the dark carcass drift with the current until it had disappeared. With the 5 remaining horses of the team, they managed to haul the coach out of the sand and onto the far shore. By then it was dark, and they drove quickly to Sheridan, where they obtained a fresh team. Sheridan was a small town of 50 wooden houses, but it seemed everyone had turned out to greet them. Johnson was surprised to see money changing hands. Earp collected a lot of it.
"What's going on?"
"They were wagering on whether we'd make it," Earp said. "I had a few bets myself."
"Which way'd you bet?"
Earp just smiled and nodded to a saloon.
"You know, it would be sporting for you to go inside with me and buy a round of whiskey."
"You think we should drink at a time like this?"
"We won't see any more trouble until Red Canyon," Earp said. "And I'm thirsty."
Red Canyon. They reached the town of Custer at 10 o'clock at night. The night was dark, and Johnson was disappointed. He couldn't see much of the most famous place in the Black Hills, the Gordon Stockade at French Creek. Just 1 year before, in 1875, the first miners of the Gordon party had built log cabins surrounded by a wooden fence 10 feet high.
They had entered the Black Hills in defiance of the Indian treaty, and they intended to pan for gold and hold off the Indians with their stockade. It had taken a cavalry expedition from Fort Laramie to get them out. In those days, the army was still enforcing the Indian treaty, and the stockade stood deserted. Now everyone at Custer was talking about the new Indian treaty. Although the government was still fighting the Sioux in the field, the cost of the war was high, already in excess of $15 million, and it was an election year. Both the expense of the fighting and the legitimacy of the government's position were hot campaign issues in Washington. Therefore, the Great White Father preferred to conclude the war peacefully, by negotiating a new treaty, and to this end, government negotiators had arranged to meet with Sioux chieftains in Sheridan. But even specially picked chiefs were disgusted by the new proposals. Most of the government negotiators agreed with them. One of them, now on his way back to Washington, said to Johnson that it was the hardest damn thing I ever did in my life. I don't care how many feathers a man wears in his hair, he's still a man. One of them, Red Legs, looked at me and said, "Do you think this is fair? Would you sign such a paper?" And I could not meet his eyes. It made me sick. "You know what Thomas Jefferson said?" the man continued. "In 1803, Thomas Jefferson said that it would take 1,000 years before the West was fully settled. And it'll be settled in less than 100 years. That's progress." Johnson recorded in his journal that he seemed an honest man sent to do a dishonest job. And now he could not forgive himself for carrying out the instructions of his government. He was drunk when we arrived, and drinking more when we left. Morgan Earp left them at Custer, and they went on without him. By midnight they had passed 4 Mile Ranch and headed into Pleasant Valley. They passed 12 Mile Ranch and 18 Mile Ranch in the darkness. Shortly before dawn, they reached the entrance to Red Canyon. The Red Canyon coach station had been burned to the ground. All the horses had been stolen. Flies buzzed around a half dozen scalped bodies, evidence of Persimmons Bill's depredations.
"Guess they didn't hear about the new treaty," Earp said laconically. "I reckon we won't be eaten here."
They proceeded immediately through the canyon. It was a tense journey. Slow because they had no fresh team, but they made it without incident. At the far end of the canyon, they followed Hawk Creek toward Camp Collier, which marked the southern entrance to the Black Hills.
Now, in the morning light, they stopped for an hour to graze the horses and to breathe a long sigh of relief. "Not long now, Mr. Johnson," Earp said, "and you'll be owing me half those bones."
Johnson decided it was time to tell him the truth.
"Mr. Earp," he began.
"Yes?"
"I appreciate everything you have done to help me get out of Deadwood naturally."
"I'm sure you do.
But there's something I have to tell you."
Earp frowned.
"You're not backing out on your deal."
"No, no." Johnson shook his head. "But I have to tell you. The crates really are just fossil bones."
"Uh-huh," Wyatt Earp said.
"They are just bones."
"I heard you."
"They are of value only to scientists, to paleontologists."
"That's fine with me."
Johnson smiled wanly. "I only hope you won't be too disappointed."
"I'll try not to be," Earp said, and winked, and punched him on the shoulder.
"You just remember, boy, half those bones are mine."
He had been a strong friend, Johnson wrote, and I suspected he would make a dangerous enemy. Thus it was with some trepidation that I resumed the journey to Fort Laramie, and the first civilization I had seen in many months. Fort Laramie. Fort Laramie was an army outpost that had grown into a frontier town, but the army garrison still set the mood, and its mood was now bitter.
The army had fought the Indians for more than 8 months and had suffered serious losses, most especially the massacre of Custer's column at the Little Bighorn. There had been other bloody engagements as well, at Powder River and Slim Buttes, but even when they were not fighting, the campaign had been harsh and arduous. But all the news from the east told them that Washington and the rest of the country did not support their efforts. Numerous articles criticized the military conduct of the campaign against the noble and defenseless red man. For young men who had seen their comrades fall, who had returned to a battle scene to bury the scalped and mutilated bodies of friends, who had seen corpses with their genitals cut off and stuffed in their mouths. For these soldiers, the Eastern commentary made for difficult reading. As far as the army was concerned, they had been ordered to undertake this war without being asked their opinion of either its feasibility or its morality. They had followed orders as best they could, and with considerable success, and they were angry now to be unsupported, and to be fighting an unpopular war. The fact that the politicians in Washington had underestimated both the difficulty of a campaign against mere savages and the outrage that it would cause among the liberal establishment of the eastern cities, uninformed writers who had never set eyes on a real Indian and who had only fantasies of what the Indians were like, was no fault of the army. As one captain put it, "They want the Indians eliminated and the lands opened up to white settlers, but they don't want anybody to get hurt in the process. That just ain't possible." Added to this was the ugly fact that the war had now entered a new phase. The army was engaged in a war of attrition with the Indians, in which they planned to kill all the buffalo and thus starve the Indians into submission. Even so, most military men expected the war to drag on for at least 3 more years, and to cost another $15 million, although nobody in Washington wanted to hear that. The arguments back and forth raged in the coach station on the outskirts of town. Johnson had an unappetizing lunch of bacon and biscuits, then sat in the sun outside the station. From where he sat, he could see the iron bridge crossing the Platte. For more than a decade, the Platte River Valley had been trumpeted by Union Pacific brochures as a flowery meadow of great fertility, clothed in nutritious grasses and watered by numerous streams. In fact, it was harsh, god-awful country. Yet the settlers were coming. From the earliest pioneer days, the Platte River itself was known as especially treacherous and difficult to cross. And this new iron bridge represented one small improvement in a series of changes that were opening the West to settlers, making it more accessible. Johnson dozed off in the sun and awoke when a voice said, "Hell of a sight, ain't it?" He opened his eyes. A tall man was smoking a cigar and staring at the bridge. "That it is," he said. "I remember last year that bridge was just talk." The tall man turned. He had a scar running down his cheek. The face was familiar, but the recognition came slowly. Navy Joe Benedict, Marsh's right-hand man. Johnson sat up quickly. He had only a moment to wonder what Navy Joe was doing here before a familiar, heavy-set figure emerged from the coach house and stood beside Benedict. Professor Marsh glanced at Johnson and said in his formal way, "Good morning to you, sir." He gave no sign of recognition and immediately turned to Benedict. "What's the delay, Joe?"
"Just hitching up a new team, Professor. We'll be ready to leave in the space of 15 or 20 minutes.
"See if you can quicken it," Marsh said. Navy Joe left, and Marsh turned to Johnson. He appeared not to recognize him, for Johnson looked very different from the last time Marsh had seen him. He was leaner and more muscled, with a full beard and hair that had not seen scissors since leaving Philadelphia more than 3 months before. It hung down almost to his shoulders. His clothes were rough and dirty, caked in mud. Marsh said, "Just passing through?"
"That's right."
"Which way you going?"
"To Cheyenne."
"Come from the hills?"
"Yeah."
Whereabouts?
Deadwood.
Mining gold?
Yeah,
Johnson said.
Strike it rich?
Not exactly, Johnson said.
What about you?
In point of fact, I myself am going north into the hills.
Mining gold? Johnson asked, to his private amusement.
Hardly. I am the professor of paleontology at Yale College, Marsh said. I study fossil bones.
That right?
Johnson could not believe that Marsh had not recognized him, but it seemed he had not.
Yes, Marsh said. And I hear there are some fossil bones to be had in Deadwood.
In Deadwood?
That right?
That's what I hear, Marsh said. Apparently a young man has them in his possession. I hope to obtain them. I am willing to pay well for them.
Oh?
Yes, indeed. Marsh took out a fat roll of greenbacks and inspected them in the sunlight.
I would also pay for information about this young man and his whereabouts.
He looked closely at Johnson.
If you take my meaning.
I don't reckon I do, Johnson said.
Well, you've just come from Deadwood, Marsh said. I wonder if you know anything of this young man.
This man got a name? Johnson asked.
His name is Johnson. He's quite an unscrupulous young fellow.
He used to work for me.
That right?
Indeed. But he left my company and threw in with a band of thieves and robbers. I believe he's wanted for murder in other territories.
That right?
Marsh nodded.
You know anything of him?
Never heard of him.
How you going to get those bones?
Buy them, if necessary, Marsh said. But I intend to have them, by whatever means may be required.
You want them bad, then?
Yes, I do, Marsh said. You see, he said, pausing for dramatic effect, these bones I'm talking about are actually mine. Young Johnson stole them from me.
Johnson felt rage sweep over him. He had been enjoying this charade, but now he was flushed with anger. It took every bit of self-control he could muster to say laconically,
"That right?
He's a lying skunk, no doubt of it," Marsh said.
"Sounds a bad one," Johnson said.
At that moment, Wyatt Earp came around the corner and said, "Hey, Johnson, on your pegs. We're moving out."
Marsh smiled at Johnson. "You little son of a bitch," he said.
The Laramie Bone Deal. It seemed, wrote Johnson in his journal, that many pigeons had come home to roost in Laramie. Most of the town was preoccupied with another figure from Johnson's past, Broken Nose Jack McCall. Jack had run from Deadwood and had gotten to Laramie, where he had bragged about killing Wild Bill Hickok. The reason he spoke so freely was that a miner's court in Deadwood had tried him for that murder, and had acquitted him when he claimed that Wild Bill had killed his young brother many years before, and he was just avenging that crime. In Laramie, Jack talked openly of killing Hickok, certain that he could not be tried twice for the same crime. But Jack didn't realize that the Deadwood Miners' Court was not legally recognized, and he was promptly thrown into jail in Laramie and formally tried for Hickok's murder. Since Jack had already publicly admitted to it, the trial was short. He was convicted and sentenced to be hanged, a turn of events that irked him mightily. While Jack's trial was going on, an episode far more important to William Johnson was occurring down the road in Sutter's saloon. Wyatt Earp was sitting at a table, drinking whiskey with Othniel C. Marsh and negotiating for the sale of half Johnson's bones. They were both hard bargainers, and it took most of the day. For his part, Earp appeared amused. Johnson sat with Miss Emily in the corner and watched the proceedings.
"I can't believe this is happening," he said.
"Why does it surprise you?" she asked.
What were my chances of running into that professor? He sighed. 1 in 1,000,000, or less. Oh, I don't think so, she said. Wyatt knew Professor Marsh was in the territory. A slow, creeping sensation moved up Johnson's spine.
He did?
Surely. How did he know?
I was with him in the hotel dining room, she said, when he heard the rumor that there was some college teacher in Cheyenne buying up all manner of fossils and asking about some bones in Deadwood. The miners were all laughing about it. But Wyatt's eyes lit up when he heard the story. Johnson frowned. So he decided to help me get the bones out of Deadwood to Cheyenne?
Yes, she said. We left the day after he heard that story.
You mean Wyatt always intended to sell my bones to Marsh from the beginning?
I believe so, she said softly. Johnson glared across the saloon at Earp.
And I thought he was my friend.
You thought he was a fool, Emily said. But he is your friend.
How can you say that? Look at him bargaining there, haggling over every dollar. At this rate, they'll be at it all day.
Yes, Emily said. Yet I'm sure Wyatt could conclude the deal in 5 minutes, if that was what he intended.
Johnson stared at her.
You mean?
She nodded. I've no doubt he's wondering why you were sitting here while he stalls Professor Marsh for you.
Oh, Emily, he cried. I could kiss you.
I wish you would, she said softly. Too many things were happening at once, wrote Johnson. My head was fairly spinning with these developments. I hurried outside with Emily and postponed kissing her in order to send her off for 100-pound sack of rice, a bolt of tarp cloth, and a long-handled shovel. Meanwhile, I hastily obtained the requisite large rocks, which fortunately were near at hand, remnants of the blasting that had been done to erect the new plant bridge. He found yet another Chinese laundry and paid a small sum to use the fire and iron kettle with which they heated water. He spent 3 hours boiling fresh rice paste, making sure the concoction was gelatinous enough, and clutching the rocks with bamboo laundry tongs and dipping them into the pasty ooze, coating them. When they were dry, he poured dust over them to make them suitably grimy. Next to the heat of the fire, they dried quickly. Finally, he removed the precious bones from all 10 crates and placed the new stones in the old crates, closing them carefully so that there would be no marks indicating they had been opened. By 5 that afternoon, he was exhausted, but all of Johnson's fossil bones were safely hidden in the back of the stable, wrapped in tarp cloth and buried under a pile of fresh manure, the shovel hidden in the straw with them, and the substitutions set out with a tarp covering, as the originals had been. Earp and Marsh arrived soon after. Marsh grinned at Johnson.
I expect this will be our last meeting, Mr. Johnson.
I hope so, Johnson said, with a sincerity Marsh could not have imagined. The division was begun. Marsh wanted to open all 10 crates and inspect the fossils before dividing, but Johnson steadfastly refused. The division was meant to be between him and Earp, and it would be done randomly. Marsh grumbled, but agreed. Midway through the process, Marsh said, I think I had better look at one of these crates to satisfy myself.
I have no objection, Earp said.
He looked directly at Johnson.
I have plenty of objections, Johnson said.
Oh?
What are they? Marsh asked.
I'm in a hurry, Johnson said.
And besides?
Besides?
There's your father,
Emily prompted him suddenly.
Yes,
there's my father, Johnson said.
How much did Professor Marsh offer you for these stones, Wyatt?
$200, Wyatt said.
$200? That's an outrage.
It is 200 more than you have, I believe, Marsh said.
Look, Wyatt, said Johnson, there's a telegraph office here in Laramie. I can cable my father for funds,
and by this time tomorrow I can give you $500 for your share. Marsh darkened. Mr. Earp, we have made our deal.
That's so, Earp said. But I like the sound of $500.
I'll give you $600, Marsh said. Now. $750, Johnson